experience about something that I had talked about during the meeting. And I thought, who is this guy? And where did he come from? And what's he doing in my meeting? And, of course, he showed up at all my meetings. It was like he was everywhere. Every meeting I went to, this guy was there. He was all over Al-Anon. And the thing that I noticed about him the most was his willingness to share from his heart his struggles, his joys, just everything that was happening in his life, he shared about openly and honestly. And he became a part of this circle of friends in our area who got together and did a lot of things socially. And we would go to the movies and go on little hikes and stuff. And we had a lot of fun, a lot of laughter. And sometimes he tends to be a little clumsy, and so he provided a lot of opportunities for humor. But we love him lots. And I think that that Al-Anon for me has been about love and about opening up, and this man was big enough to let us all love him out of his insanity into some serenity. And I think it takes a lot to open up and to let the love of this program in, and that's the thing that I admire about him most, is how big his heart is. And he's got a heart as big as the state of Texas, where he's originally from. And with that, I'd like to turn this over to Travis C. from Pleasanton.
Hi, everybody. My name's Travis. And I can honestly say I am a grateful member of this program called Al-Anon. And I can honestly tell you that my palms are sweating and I'm nervous, but you know, one of the things that I try to do before I do this is I pray to my higher power that I call God, and ask that my words be His words. And I was told this morning at breakfast that if I share that with you, and you have a problem with something that I say this morning, then you know where to take your complaints to. So. You know, this is such a wonderful program for me, and I look around this room and I see faces of people that I have grown to know and to love, and people who have thrown lifelines to me and when I was in the midst of my despair. And one of the things that's so wonderful about those lifelines is when I was drowning in this pit of insanity and despair that I was in, the folks that threw those lifelines didn't just throw them down and say, here it is, grab on. They came down and shared with me how they had been where I was at, and showed me how to hold on to that lifeline, and walked me up the side of that pit and stood beside me while I caught my breath, came back down and got me when I didn't fall. I jumped back down. So it's such a wonderful feeling for me to have the opportunity to stand up here and share with you my experience and my strength and what a tremendous amount of hope I have. I would like to say that everything that I have to say this morning is borrowed from God. And that loan is either mostly through what I have heard or what I have read in this program, what people have shared or what people have written. Perhaps a tiny bit of it is personal inspiration provided to me from my higher power. The goal of what I have for this morning is that I would like to be able to provide hope for those of you who are newcomers. If you haven't been here very long, there's a lot of hope in this program. And I'd like to share the gratitude that I have for those seasoned members who are in this program who have thrown those lifelines to me and to so many of the rest of us. I plan on talking about what life was like for me before I got to Al-Anon, what Al-Anon has done for me since I've joined it, and what I hope it's going to do for me in the future. I need to share about where I was, because it's an important part of my story. And I know for me that when I came to these meetings, it was important for me to be able to relate to what the person was saying. And so what I want to share with you is that I've been there and I've done that, and I bought that T-shirt. For those of you who don't know me, I was born on October the 13th of 1952, but I actually began living at 9:30 a.m. on February the 12th of 1994. Now, that's only a year and a half ago. I'm a newcomer in this program, just like a lot of the rest of you. I'm 18 months old in this particular life. And I happen to be looking at a book about child development yesterday. And, you know, if you read the section on 18-month-old children, they're just beginning to learn how to walk, and they're just beginning to learn how to talk, and they're just beginning to make sense out of these words that they've already been hearing, but they're just beginning to put those words together. And I thought one of the interesting parts of what I read was that when you're 18 months old, you do a lot of backing up, and that's kind of where I am in my program. I practice backing up quite a lot sometimes, just to get the feeling for it. I don't like it back there anymore. I'm going to move forward, I think. And also, moving forward in a straight line is okay. It's going around corners. That's pretty tough for 18 months old. And so when I get thrown a curve in this program, like a cashier that won't change a $20 bill for me, you know, my insanity comes back pretty quickly. And one of the other interesting things I read is that 18-month-old children like to squat a lot because they're comfortable there. And that's what I like to do, is I like to just stop and squat, and I'm real comfortable right where I am for a given period of time. Also, I guess what I want to share with you is what I want to talk about today, what my topics are going to be about. I'm going to need to share with you this morning as part of my story about anger and about rage and about insanity. And I want to say from the get-go here that if those topics make you uncomfortable, I want to apologize about that. I want to apologize for any offense or pain that I might cause to you for what I'm going to share about those topics. They are an important part of my story. They share with you about where I was, and perhaps will help you understand how far I've come. I want to talk about detachment, and I want to talk about hope and faith and growth and service in this program. As I shared with you, I was born in 1952 in Fort Worth, Texas, into a home that was, it's fair to say, I believe, my observation is that it was a dysfunctional home, although it was not an alcoholic home. My parents, from my earliest memories, slept in separate bedrooms. I remember a lot of rage and anger and screaming and fighting. And I remember being chased around the house by my father with a belt in his hand a few times. But there was no, as far as I can remember, there was no alcohol involved in my early years. Now, as I grew up, I had two older siblings who were 15 years older than, one is 15 years older than I am, one was 7 years older than I am, and so they married alcoholic, one of them married an alcoholic spouse, and the other one became an alcoholic. And so as I got older, I began to be exposed to alcoholism, although I didn't really understand what that disease was all about. In the eighth grade, I met a woman who I eventually married right out of high school. That marriage provided me with two wonderful children. That particular lady is a very good woman, and she is a very high quality individual. I have to share with you that the reason that I'm not married to her anymore is all mine. It was my boredom with the relationship. It was my immaturity with the relationship. I was looking for something else. And about 12 years into that marriage, I found something else, and it was another woman. And this woman was exciting. This woman liked to party. And boy, did she know how to party. Very exciting in the beginning of that relationship. Now, early on in that relationship, eventually I left my first wife and moved into an apartment. And very early in that second relationship, there were clues to the insanity that was to follow. And I can look backward and see those clues now. There were drunken, insane arguments. I had grown quite used to abusing alcohol myself. I'm not a member of AA, and only by the grace of God am I not. But I was doing a lot of heavy drinking back then. I remember once I got a phone call in the middle of the night from her, and she was in jail, and she wanted me to come bail her out of jail. And she wanted to make sure that I got her bailed out of jail before her children woke up the next morning. And I spent all night long finding enough money from various sources to get her bailed out of jail. Those were some of the clues that I had about what was to follow, but I didn't recognize what they were. Over time, it began to worsen. But for me and my denial, I didn't really recognize to what degree things were worsening. I'm kind of like that, you know, I've heard the story about the frog that you can put in the petri dish, and if you turn the heat up slow enough, that frog will stay there and just boil away. And that's the way I was in the midst of this insanity. I eventually got a job to where we moved in together and set up house, and for 6 years we didn't get married, and we eventually got married. But I got a job where I began to travel. Began to experience financial problems. The house we were living in was foreclosed. My auto was repossessed. There began to be problems with her work. I would come home to evidence of problems with the children. Things like vandalism, running away, poor grades. And I'd come home to just amazing damage in the home. On the weekends, I'd come home and find holes in the wall. And I remember one weekend I came home and found holes about that big around, size of a quarter, in the bathroom door. And I couldn't imagine what had put those holes in there. And I discovered that they were holes that were put in there from a hammer that my wife had used on that door because my stepdaughter had locked herself in the bathroom. And for me, at that point in time, all of these problems, the holes in my children's walls, the running away, the poor grades, the vandalism, were all my children's problems. They were things I blamed on the children. I could not bring myself, or didn't understand to bring myself, to blame them on the alcoholism in our home. During this period in our relationship, my brother died, and you know, I wasn't aware of Al-Anon's gift for at least a couple of 3 years to come, but I qualified for this program with my brother, who is 7 years older, born 7 years before I was. I qualified for this program long before I met my second wife. He was an alcoholic and a drug addict to a degree that I'm sure most of you have been exposed to. It caused me a lot of grief and a lot of discussions with him about how he needed to get himself fixed. I know none of you have had those kinds of discussions with the people that you love. But in this period of time, in this second marriage, my brother died, and it was his disease that he died from. And our insanity was so high in our home, and between my second wife and I, that trying to support my sister-in-law, his widow, and her daughter in the midst of their grief was just impossible. And there was a lot of insanity and a lot of anger and resentment in that whole event of my brother's death. I also experienced what I've heard called the cycles of repeating pain. And I just kind of want to walk you through what those were for me, because they were so much a part of my insanity in this relationship. The first step in the cycle of repeating pain is intense pleasure. Wonderful experiences, take trips, party hard, just a lot of pleasure, intense pleasure. The second one then is intense pain, anger, resentment, screaming, drunken arguments. Three is disillusionment. You know, what's going on here? What went wrong? Fourth one, blaming my partner. This is about me, and this is about blaming my partner. It's all my partner's fault. But she would convince me that it was my fault. It was my anger and my rage and my screaming. And thus I would blame myself. And I would take some kind of what is the sixth-step desperate action to correct the situation. We would do something desperate to try to fix our insanity. And then that would create step one, intense pleasure. And we'd start that insanity all over again. Over time, I began to realize that our drinking was too intense. I realized this even before we were married. There was a St. Patrick's Day where I realized that we were both drinking too much. And she kept drinking, and I didn't that particular day. And I explained to her how she needed to stop drinking. And again, I know this is something you folks have never done. But I took it on myself to explain to her how much she was drinking. And I poured the whiskey bottle, the whiskey down the sink, and that's the first time that I learned that trying to get in between an alcoholic and their drug of choice is a dangerous place to be. Because she took that whiskey bottle and hit me over the head with it. That was also the very first event in our relationship where things got violent, because I hit her back, and it was the first time in my life that I had ever hit a female. And I had this egotistical perspective that guys didn't hit girls, and I was never going to do that. And when I did that, at that moment in time in my life, I felt convinced that I needed to do something about my drinking. So I stopped drinking hard liquor. Wine and beer were okay, but the hard liquor, that was out. Now, this was also a moment in time that she promised she was going to stop drinking or cut down on her drinking herself. One of many times that promise was extracted by me. I was traveling. Things were getting continuing to worsen. And in May of 1993, I had a spiritual experience to which I'll only share a part of. I came to know the God as I understand Him today. Began to know Him as I understand Him today. And I know that one of our obstacles says that we don't want to discuss religion, and it's not allied with any sect or denomination. And so I won't get into any of the religious aspect of what happened to me, but what I will say is that I thought going to church was going to fix this problem. And one of the things that we started doing at that point in time was began some counseling with a pastor, which, in fact, did me personally a lot of good. But I thought that going to church was
going to fix our problem. And after that, I was going to need help.
I'd like to read to you a poem. Some of you may be familiar with it, but this is a very great thought about where my life was at this particular moment in time. The title of the poem is Broken Dreams. As children bring their broken toys with tears for us to mend, I brought my broken dreams to God because He was my friend. But then instead of leaving Him in peace to work alone, I hung around and tried to help with ways that were my own. At last I snatched them back and cried, "How could you be so slow?" "My child," he said, "what could I do? You never did let go." And that's where my life was I didn't understand how to turn this stuff over to God. I just thought God was going to help us fix it. By the middle of 1993, things really began to unravel for us. A car was wrecked in Oklahoma. There was an arrest for DUI, and of course it was my responsibility to take care of getting her out of jail and getting the car fixed. But in that process of doing some research, I discovered that we didn't have any insurance and hadn't had any insurance for 6 months. She was driving without a license. We were being sued for a previous accident when we didn't have the insurance. I didn't know that we didn't have. And I didn't know we were being sued because when I was traveling, the letters would come in and they'd get hidden. And so things really began to unravel at that point, and I made it very clear to her that if she didn't stop drinking, I was going to leave the marriage. And what I didn't understand at that point in time was the definition of an idle threat, because she had figured out by this point in time that I had made that threat enough that she didn't really have to correct her behavior. But I was convinced that somehow I had to stop, I had to get her to stop drinking. And so she promised, I'll stop drinking. But if I'm going to stop drinking, you have to stop drinking to support me in this process. And I said, okay. And I stopped drinking. And from that moment in time, I haven't had any alcoholic intake to speak of. Now, I just want to say, a program of honesty, I've had some wine at one dinner, and I've had a beer at one lunch, but from an aspect of alcoholic intake, my alcoholic intake since that point in time has been very, 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 very close to zero. And for the last year and a half, it has been zero. But for me, that's when my insanity really began. Because still not understanding this disease called alcoholism, I stopped drinking. And I began to continue to see evidence of her drinking, and I could not understand why she wouldn't stop drinking. I found bottles, I saw evidence of it, and my rage would be so high, I'd throw bottles across the room. I would have screaming, rageful, abusive rage attacks. My insanity was growing so high because I could not understand why she would be willing to jeopardize our home, our marriage, our family, the children's welfare, why she'd be willing to jeopardize all these things for the alcohol. So I became convinced in late 1993 that the way to correct this was to be home. Because if I was home and wasn't traveling, I could control this behavior. So I had an opportunity to move to California to not have to travel. So that's what we planned on doing. And towards the end of 1993, I did a geographic. I rented a home here, put a deposit down on a home here in California, turned in the notice on the house we were living in. Rented a truck, got the truck, started loading on a Sunday or Monday with the intent of being here before Christmas. The very day that we started loading that truck, she came home blasted, for lack of a better term. Now, I'm not sure what it was exactly that motivated her to do that particular evening, because before it had all been covert. It had been, hidden. But this particular evening, I guess, I don't know, I can only guess, and I won't do that. But the fact is that she came home drunk, and I knew that there was something that I had to do to convince her that I was serious about her not drinking. So I closed the back of that truck, and I parked it in front of the house, and the next morning I went to see a lawyer. And I filed for divorce in the state of Texas. And we were doing some counseling with this pastor, and they served her papers on the church parking lot on our way to a counseling session. And I was convinced that I was going to shock her into reality. I'm serious about getting a divorce if you don't stop drinking. And it shocked her all right. And through a very intense 3 days worth of counseling sessions, I became convinced that she was going to stop drinking. She convinced me. She convinced my son, who at the time was 15, who was going to move in with us and move out here to California. She convinced her two children, who were my stepchildren, that she was going to stop drinking. So we all became convinced that life was going to be glorious in California. And so we spent the next few days loading up the truck. On Christmas Eve morning, we departed Dallas and headed to California. Now, if you could have seen us, we were a combination of the Beverly Hillbillies, the Grapes of Wrath, and the Chevy Chase's Holiday Vacation. We had Christmas morning in a La Quinta hotel with a little tree that stood about a foot and a half tall and little balls on it. And at that point in time, my son, my 15-year-old son, was a pretty crazy guy. And I forgot to tell you why he was with us. It was because his mother couldn't control him, but I knew I could. So things were pretty insane on that trip for us, although I have to say I don't believe that there was any alcohol involved in that trip. At the end of the year, as far as the IRS is concerned, or the state of California, it was on January the 1st of 1994, we arrived in our new home and began to set up house. 2 weeks after we arrived here, the drinking started again. On January the 26th, on my son's 16th birthday, I came home to him and her in just a screaming battle about something he had done. And of course, I was responsible to correct this behavior and to be the lion tamer between these two lions. And so I got in the middle of it. And the screaming started, and the anger continued, and things got physical again. And I'm not proud to admit, but I have to tell you that part of my story is that in the midst of that violence, and I could share with you how innocent I was, but the fact is what happened shouldn't have happened, but I ended up going to jail. And I went to jail for a domestic violence with an injury. And this old boy from Texas didn't understand that domestic violence with injury in the state of California is a felony. And I didn't find that out until I got to jail. And they put me in a cell block with the bad boys. And when I finally got out 24 hours later, I knew I never wanted to go back to that place again. And that is truly the point in time where I began hitting my bottom. I think my bottom was like a stone you skip across the water. You know, I hit that bottom about three or four times before I really stopped. But I began to realize that I could not control her behavior. I was trying to do everything I knew how, and I couldn't stop it, couldn't control it through intimidation. I'd learned I couldn't control it through physical activities. I remember, and one of the things that the officer told me that arrested me, very professional guy, I have nothing but the highest level of respect for the police officers in Pleasanton, California, and they protect my home and my family, and I just can't say enough good things about them. And this fella tried to make it very clear to me that if it happens again, if you get into that state of argument again, call us before it gets physical. And that's what I learned to do. We got to know about every cop on our beat. Because I did not want to go back to jail, and I didn't want any potential, even a blemish of potential that I might have that happen. So the police were pretty regulars at our home, and one of the things that I decided was that I needed to protect myself. Now, this was pre-Al-Anon, but I was already beginning to figure out that I needed to do something to protect myself, and I needed to control her behavior because she was driving this car when she was intoxicated, and she could go out there and hurt somebody, and I could get sued, like I'd already been done once and didn't know about. And so I bought $150 worth of these clubs that you put on the steering wheel of the car. I have three cars, and one for each car. And when I was convinced that she'd been drinking too much, well, I just simply locked down the cars, you know. And so one day I locked down all the cars before I left, and I went out and did some errands or something. Being a self-supporting person, I was fairly flexible with my time, and I picked my son up from school in the afternoon and came home to her back in the car out of the driveway. And I said to myself, I thought I locked that car down. What, you know, and I pulled up behind her. She was backing out, and I pulled up behind her. Well, and I grabbed the keys, and boy, you can imagine the scene that started then. So there I was on the phone again. Hello, police officer, you know. Come to find out, she had hired a locksmith to come out to take that club off the car. Now, I was really beginning to understand that I could not control this behavior. Talk about powerless. There I was. But my dilemma was, my insanity was that I was in this box, because now I have absolutely no control. I have no choices. I couldn't leave because I'm responsible. I'm the, you know, if I were to leave, and she's such a case that she couldn't possibly take care of herself, so I have to stick around and you know, hold this whole family up. But I hated staying. I couldn't leave, but I hated staying. And it was that moment in time in my life that I began to have darker thoughts. And again, I'm not proud about admitting it, but it's part of my story. And I didn't think very long about them, but I began having thoughts about murder or suicide or both. And I knew that I needed some help. And I thank God today for a lady by the name of Lisa who pointed me at Al-Anon. Because on Saturday, February the 12th of 1994, I walked in my first Al-Anon meeting. And I cried my eyes out. And I got lots of hugs. And one of the ladies there handed me a brochure, a little flyer on detachment. Because I had shared with those folks in that room about how my wife was killing herself with drinking. And see, I wasn't there to fix myself. I was there to find out how to get her to stop drinking. It was my last resort, but I was there to find out how to get her to stop drinking. And the folks there, and in other meetings to follow, began to help me understand that I don't have any control over anyone else's behavior. I only have control over my own actions and my own attitudes. Personally, irrevocably responsible for everything. That's my job. Thanks God. So after that day, I began working my program. One of the first things I heard was to not make any major changes in my life for at least 6 months. I said, okay, I can do that. I began to learn about detachment, began to learn about letting go, began to understand that this person in my life was an adult, is an adult, that she's responsible for her own behavior, and that one of the things I needed to do was let her experience the natural consequences of her own behavior. Her drinking and her choices were her business and not mine. How I behaved around that was my business. I learned that the three C's. I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I sure can't cure it. But one of the other things I learned that I was doing was I was contributing to the insanity in our home. I went to lots of meetings. I got lots of hugs. And I like to share about the fact that in the beginning, those hugs made me uncomfortable. Now, The hugs from the ladies didn't make me particularly uncomfortable. But the hugs from these big burly guys with beards, I got to tell you, they made me uncomfortable. But I learned to enjoy those and to recognize them for what they are. For me, what they are is a hug is a spiritual sharing between two people. And I'm convinced that the stronger of the two shares that with the weaker of the two. And boy, was I weak, and I got a lot of strength from those hugs. I began reading the literature, Courage to Change, the ODAT, the other books and brochures. I learned pretty quickly, and everyone has to do this at their own pace, but I learned pretty quickly that I needed a sponsor because I wanted to learn how to get what some of these people that had this serenity, I wanted to learn how to get it. And I started working the steps. And I got a good sponsor, a very good sponsor. And by the way, I'd like to stop at this moment and share with the fact that my sponsor is a fellow by the name of Larry. And he's going to be going in for some surgery on the 21st of this month. And for those of you who believe in the power of prayer, I'd like to ask you to pray for him. He's going to have some serious surgery. His odds are okay, but they're not weighed a lot in the favor of him even coming out of the operation room. But Larry has given me so much strength and shared with me his experience, strength, and hope. And he loves me when I need loving, and he kicks my butt when I need it kicked. I got involved in Alateen. Went to an event that's not actually billed as an Alateen event, but it has a lot of Alateens there, called the Growing Together Weekend. Went to some NOCAC events. And for those of you who haven't been to an Alateen event, if you want a spiritual experience, get together with some of those Alateens. When I talked earlier about the seasoned members that I'm so grateful for, it's not chronological age that has anything to do with it. It's the people in this program who have shared with me their experience, strength, and hope. And some of those people are only 14, 15, 16 years old. I found out that they sell movie tickets for one. What a concept. I began to enjoy a lot of social events with my friends. And I found a good, solid, strong church home. Now, one of the things I heard in one of the meetings that I went to was that when one person gets in recovery and the other person doesn't, sometimes, often, the two people begin to grow apart. And so what I was experiencing at home was, as I was beginning to detach and began to go to these movies and find myself with people who wanted that recovery and who were approaching sanity and wanted recovery and wanted the serenity, I found the insanity in our home was at least from one side of the relationship, my perspective was growing. Now, during this particular period of time, she got another DUI. So close to our home that the officer walked down the street, knocked on the door, and said, "Would you mind driving the car up to the driveway so that we don't have to tow it away?" And I was sad, but I knew that what I had to do was nothing. Because what I had learned by this point in time is that my behavior of saving her from the natural consequences of her own behavior was only preventing her from hitting her own bottom. If I do things to make an alcoholic comfortable in their drinking, they're never, or at least I won't give them the opportunity, I won't help them reach the bottom that they need to reach before they're going to seek recovery. So they took her away to jail that night. And you remember I told you that some years before, I had spent all night trying to get her out of jail. This particular evening, I turned the phones down. I went to bed. I got up the next morning. I have one of those recorders that counts the number of calls that you have. I had 17 messages on my recorder when I got up that morning. But I had a sense of serenity that I was doing the right thing. Now, I did go pick her up from the jail. And perhaps in my controlling behavior, I did say these words: "Are you sure you don't need to get some help for this?" And she said, "Yeah, you know, maybe I do. But I don't want to stay in one of those places for 28 days. Well, that just ratcheted me up. And I said, "Well, you know that 28 days is what you need." And she, through some negotiation on my part, became convinced that a treatment program is where she needed to be. And that's where she went, into a 28-day treatment program. And I found out about this thing called a pink cloud, because she got into recovery, and I was convinced that life was going to be wonderful. And I would go visit her, and I'd see her health returning, and her, you know, her strength returning, and you know, my pink cloud went from the 9th floor to the 12th floor, and even higher. She came out of that 28-day treatment program with tapes and books and program and friends, and I was convinced that we were both in recovery. And 2 weeks later, she started drinking again. And I didn't know what I was going to do, because I was convinced that I never wanted to re-enter the insanity that I had been in before. And one of my friends in this program said to me, "You know, when I don't know what to do, the best thing for me to do is nothing except pray." And that's what I began to do. I began to pray and meditate, and I just about became convinced that this relationship was not going to be right for me. But I wasn't sure, and I kept staying on the fence, and I just wasn't sure. And a few things happened in my life between us in that time that I believe today was a message from God that said, "Travis, it is time for you to end this relationship." I'd like to read a page out of The Courage to Change that made a big difference in my life at that point in time. It's the August 6th page. It's page 219. I hope I can get all the way through this page. Thank you, Vic. "I dreamt that I was trapped in a burning room. Thick smoke filled the air, and the only exit door was blocked by fire. As I gasped for breath, a hand appeared behind the flames, beckoning me to come. I knew that freedom, light, and air were on the other side of that door, and that certain death awaited me if I remained. Still, I hesitated. How could I walk through the fire? Sometimes I feel the same way about the challenges I face in my waking life. Even when my position is hopeless and my higher power beckons, urging me to take a risk, I still hesitate, hoping for a miracle. I forget that the miracle is already here. Today, thanks to Al-Anon, I have a higher power who is always there for me, helping me to cope with my fears and find new, effective solutions to my problems. Thus, I am taken beyond the problems that once held me hostage. I am free to act or not to act, to take a chance, to hold off on a decision, to make choices that feel right. Today's reminder says it takes courage to step beyond what is comfortable, predictable, and known. Courage is a gift from my higher power that I find in the rooms of Al-Anon and in the hearts of its members. Courage faces fear and thereby masters it. was written by Martin Luther King Jr. This is where I was in my life. On June the 24th of 1994, I got on an airplane and I flew back to Texas, and I finalized that divorce that I had filed for before I left. I flew into Texas a married person. I flew out a single person. I knew that it was the right thing for me to do for my life. Now, I'd like to stop here and also say a couple of other things. One is, perhaps there's some of you out there that feel like I didn't work my program strongly enough, or that I didn't give her enough opportunities, or, you know, that I was too hasty in my decision. And the only thing I can say to that is that one of the things I've learned in this program is that what you think about me is none of my business. And so I know that this was the right decision for myself. The other thing I want to share is that for the folks who are newcomers in this program, this is not a program about how to divorce your alcoholic spouse. This is a program about taking care of yourself. This is a program about choices. There are lots and lots and lots of miracles in this program about marriages that have hung together through lots of insanity. So I just want to say that at this point. Today, I have a faith and relationship with the higher power that I call God that I've never known before in my adult life. I am learning, and it's important for me to say learning because most of these things I haven't learned. I'm only in the process of learning them. I'm learning to let go. I'm learning that I'm not another person's higher power. I'm learning that it's His will and not mine. I'm praying for that. I've learned about prayer and meditation. I work my program hand in glove. Now, this is my program, and I work it hand in glove with my religion and the church home that I have. I found that one complements the other. I found that church and my religion gave me one thing, and I found that this program gave me some tools to learn how to use the other. And I just want to emphasize that one of the things that I found in working this program is that the other person that I'm working with doesn't have to necessarily have the same religious convictions or perceptions that I have, because this is a spiritual program, not a religious program. And for me, it's kind of like someone helping me learn how to drive a car. They don't have to drive the same kind of car I drive. They just need to know how to work a steering wheel and a gear shift and brakes and pedal, you know, clutch and all those things, and show me how to keep from crashing this thing. And that's kind of where I am with that. I'm very much feeling a continued growth in God's love and presence for me. I've learned about love. I've learned about love in these rooms like I never dreamed possible. I've learned about trust. And I've learned that I always have choices. I have a relationship that's built on all these things today with a woman that I love very much. I've learned about detachment. Now, I mentioned that I got divorced on June the 24th, but those two stepchildren that were with us continued to live in my home after the divorce, and my son still lives there. And I've learned that with my children, I cannot control their behavior, I can only control their consequences. And this has been a tremendous struggle for me, because when I learned about letting go of my alcoholic spouse and learned about the fact that she was an adult and she needed to accept the natural consequences of her own behavior, that was really pretty easy for me to understand and comprehend. But for my children, it's been a greater struggle for me, because when children are tiny, letting go and letting God doesn't work. You know, we have to take them out of the middle of the street when they run out there. We have to make them, you know, do some of the things for their own safety. And what I struggle with is realizing that my children are now old enough to be making conscious decisions on their own, and I cannot control those decisions. And I'm learning the difference between control and boundaries. I remember sitting down at the kitchen table when I first got into this program and I heard about boundaries, and I said, wow, boundaries, I got those, you know. And I sat down and I drew this on this piece of paper. I drew this square, and I sat down with my, I think it was 12 or 13-year-old stepson. I said, okay, here are your boundaries. Now, as long as you stay within these boundaries, you can do anything you want, but outside of these boundaries, you can't. And what I'm learning today is that was control. Because it's kind of like a corral. For me, it's kind of like a corral. He was in the corral, and I was controlling whether or not he could get out of the corral. Now, boundaries are protection against other people's behavior. And so I have visually in my mind now that I'm in the corral, and all these other folks can do whatever they want to do as long as they don't punch through my boundaries. Now, with my children, some of these boundaries include legal responsibilities that I have over their behavior and things that they, I'm sure, still perceive to be control. But those are the kinds of things that I'm struggling with and how I'm trying to visualize the difference between the two for me. And I continue to get them mixed up. One of the other things I've learned is that what other people do with their lives is their business, and it's not mine. Now, I talked about my alcoholic having choices, qualifier for this program, having choices of her own, and it was none of my business. But this program for me is about living life. It's not just about dealing with the effects of alcoholism. It's about dealing with the fact that, you know, other people get to make decisions for themselves that are none of my business. It's about progress and not perfection. I am convinced that the miracle for me is in working the 12 steps, and I need to work them all. Because I've heard and I believe that if I only work steps 1, 2, and 3, I'm going to continue to work steps 1, 2, and 3 over and over. I still jump back into that old behavior quite often. It's seldom as intense as it used to be, and I seem to be able to recover faster. Remember I talked about the way I felt was I was in this pit of despair and people would come down and help show me up. Well, we put handholds and footholds in the wall for me to grab back onto as I go back up. So I get out of it faster. I realize I'm there quicker. I mentioned I think that for me the step work is where the miracle is. That's where the miracle is for me. I love going to meetings. I love doing social things. But for me, I'm not going to get well until I work the steps. And I believe that it's possible to work some of them out of order. I think that 1, 2, and 3 are integrally linked. I can't, God can, and I need to let Him. Steps 4 through 9 need to be built on those 3. It's essential in my mind for me to do them in order. I think they build on one another. Steps 10 through 12, however, I think, for me at least, I began shortly after I joined the program. Step 10, which is, you know, essentially when I'm wrong, promptly admitted it, is something I'm learning to do more and more. I'm trying to learn the difference between amends and saying I'm sorry. Saying I'm sorry means I might do it again, you know, but I'm sorry I did it this time. Making amends to me says I'm going to change my behavior. And I'm going to do my dead level best not to ever let it happen again. Step 11, improve my conscious contact with God. I think it's important that I keep that relationship and continue to let it grow. And step 12, carrying this message to others in all of our affairs, to me is such an important piece for my recovery. I mentioned I worked in the Alateen program. I'm a co-sponsor for a meeting. I try to get to as many Alateen events as I can. I just think it's a wonderful experience for me to understand what those young adults are going through. I think it's an, you know, being able to stand up here in front of you and speak is an incredible opportunity for me. And one of the things I want to share with you, which I think is a Step 12 event, is my niece that I mentioned to you was, you know, we had a hard time supporting when my brother died just recently graduated from high school. And when I learned about Alateen, I tried to get her to get involved in Alateen. She lives in Southern California. And she, for whatever reasons that were her choices, decided it wasn't the right thing for her to do. But as a part of her graduation present, I sent her the book, From Survival to Recovery. And I'd like to read this this thank you card that I got from her. It says, "Dear Uncle Travis," this girl, by the way, has such a special place in my heart. It says, "Thank you so much, very much, for my graduation gifts. $100 is so much, and I truly appreciate it. The Ziggy doll was great, and I smile every time I see it. The book may have been the best. At first, I didn't really look at it because I didn't think I really had any problems from Dad. But my God, when I read it, I just nodded throughout the whole book. I'm reading it again for the second time." And that, to me, is one of the gifts of this program, is to be able to share our experience, strength, and hope, whether it be verbally or in writing, about what this program can do for folks. For me, I'm looking forward to the fact that the journey has really just begun, and it will never end. It only gets better. There's not a graduation from Al-Anon. There's lots of hope for me. There's plenty of evidence that miracles are available in this program. I've been out at sea on a sailboat in a hurricane, but the seas have calmed and the sun is out. I'm standing on a raft that I've built of the debris, and I'm almost dry. I've sighted shore, and I'm headed towards it. While there's still an occasional storm, I am learning to trust in God. Those of you who are new, keep coming back. There are lots of miracles to be had in this program. Those of you who are seasoned, keep sharing your experience, strength, and hope. We need that. Thanks for the people in this room who love me. And thanks to all of you for letting me love you.